CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First interview was a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Brendan Waite will be telling us a little bit about Fragile X. So, can you tell me a little bit about your work with Fragile X International?
So, Fragile X International is a very young organization. We've just launched it in last April, April 22. It's actually an umbrella organization, an umbrella association, for family associations throughout the world who deal with a Fragile X, and particularly Fragile X syndrome. Maybe I could say a few words about Fragile X to start with.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Fragile X is it's a genetic condition that is, how can I say this? It's an inherited genetic condition, and it causes particularly Fragile X syndrome, but also various other problematics. And Fragile X syndrome is it's the most common inherited form of intellectual, developmental, and learning disability. It's also a known genetic cause of autism. Not all the people who have Fragile X syndrome have autism, but some do. And it causes intellectual disability and also some behavioral problems. And it's been discovered 30 years ago, a little bit over 30 years ago. And basically it affects 1 in 4,000 females and about one in 4,000 males and 1 in 6,000 females. So it's a rare disease. It's a rare condition, the families have been struggling and fighting for 30 years now to help people who have Fragile X. Some organizations started in different countries, in the US, in Canada, in France, all over Europe. And a little over 10, 11 years ago in Europe, we decided to meet each other throughout different countries. And there was, I think, 7 or 8 different countries who met and decided to share best practices and help each other out. And 10 years after that, there was 18 of us going strong, and we decided that we would like to to help other associations around the world, to do a little bit more advocacy for Fragile X, to be better known in the world. And that's why we decided to launch Fragile X International.
So how do you go about reaching out to organizations around the world to let them know that you can partner with them and provide support in their efforts?
So what we did is we actually tried to gather information on the internet and on various social networks to get any type of organization that we could find. To be honest, there's not that many of them. I told you previously that there was 18 of us in Europe, and we managed to maybe find 20 other around the world for the moment. And we basically reached out to all of them, explaining our project and, of course, our vision, because we have a specific vision on the way we want to help people with Fragile X, and asking them if they wanted to join or, you know, to get the network going, because these things take some time. And so far we've talked to at least 10 of them, and some are interested and some are happy that we're launching the project, and it's very interesting and very overwhelming to actually get to meet people from everywhere around the world who's fighting for the same cause.
So, in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about Fragile X?
Oh, yes, a lot, yeah. Probably in the world of Fragile X, there's a lot of stigma, because it's a condition where there is an intellectual disability, and it's always... It can sometimes be perceived as a negative thing by the, I would say, the standard society that we live in. And for us, it's a little bit different, because most of the people who have Fragile X are very happy people and always smiling, and they have lots of other features that are really interesting and hyper... How can I say this in English? Sorry, my English is not perfect. What they lack sometimes in intellectual, they have with emotions, and the way they interact with people is sometimes amazing. We recognize that all people with Fragile X, have equal value. Everybody with intellectual disability also, of course, and they're entitled to the same opportunities as everyone else. And we sort of want to change the way they are perceived, because we keep struggling and asking them to change, to fit into our societies, where we kind of believe it's the other way around it should happen. And we're wondering what society can do to make a correct place for them, you know? So that's one of the biggest misconceptions, I would say.
So, in your time working with Fragile X International, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Well, there's been quite a few, even though the official Fragile X International has only been existing for a couple of months. The group and the network that we all share have been working for 10 years now, as I said. The first thing we're quite happy of is the fact that we have an International Fragile X Day on October 10th every year. So why is it October 10th? It's because it's XX in Roman numbers. So we thought XX for Fragile X was quite a good way of remembering it.
Very ingenious.
and the other thing is that we started doing some advocacy on the way, how can I say this, on getting rid of some of the stigmas and that was going around for Fragile X. And we started doing some, advocacy on this. And one of our colleagues wrote a scientific paper on this, and it was published, and we managed to get the name change, and it is now, it's just been officially announced in July, and we're very happy about this, because the whole of the scientific community now is going to change the name of the of our gene, the scientific name, and it's all because of parents and families who decided to, you know, to make a stand, and that's one of our biggest achievements.
Well, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yes.
In this segment of our show, Samantha Rayburn Trubick will be telling us a little bit about LPA. So can you tell me a little bit about LPA?
Yeah, so Little People of America, we're a nonprofit organization, and we provide support and information to people of short stature and their families. You know, we are just a support organization and an advocacy organization for little people.
So how do you reach out to those affected with short stature?
How do we reach out? Well, you know, various ways. So we, you know, through the internet, through social media, through word of mouth. You know, it's kind of a combination. With Little People of America, there's about 4,000 to 5,000 members. So those members alone will reach out to other folks as they come in contact with people who may not know about us. But generally, social media, internet, the general ways.
So I'm guessing that in dealing with people with short stature, that would include people with things like Turner syndrome and whatnot, which can have an effect on a person's height and physical appearance.
You got it, yeah.
So in your work, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions about little people?
All the time. There are so many stereotypes. I mean, there's so many. So, you know, I think some of the stereotypes are, you know, the misconceptions are that we're just, you know, here to be munchkins or to be, you know, leprechauns or to be, you know, really not to provide any value other than entertainment value for society.
So how do you go about getting around those myths and misperceptions and educating the public?
I think through advocacy. You know, we've had some great wins with advocacy. You know, for example, October is Dwarfism Awareness Month. Little People of America has defined it as October as Dwarfism Awareness Month. October 25th is Dwarfism Awareness Day. And so I think using that as our kind of foundation and our platform to spread knowledge and awareness and advocate through some of those myths, we've been able to have some real successes. You know, a lot of folks are advocating in some really great ways and combating these stereotypes. And, you know, we've got a lot of intelligent, driven adult little people living by example and setting great examples for our future generations.
So through the Awareness Month, what are some of the specific campaigns that have proven especially successful?
Well, I would say one of the big campaigns is removing the term midget from people's vocabulary. That's a highly offensive term and something that we continue to advocate against. We've had some great successes, I mean, especially in Canada alone, but in the U.S. as well. Speaking from Canada, we've been able to, for example, through Little People of Manitoba Sports dropped the term several years ago, All Manitoba Sports, as well as Hockey Canada followed suit shortly thereafter. We continue to see, unfortunately, the word used time, you know, from time to time. So as we find out, you know, or we see this word being used, we you know, tend to advocate more and speak to people who may not be aware that it's highly offensive.
So do you find the public is generally responsive to being educated in that sense? Do you find that when you say that's an offensive term, that they respond with, oh, I didn't know that, or be more careful in my wording sort of thing?
Sometimes. I think personally, yes. I do think change is hard for a lot of people. And I think that, you know, when we're advocating, we do come up against folks that are just more of the, well, I didn't mean it that way, or that wasn't my intention, or that's not what it really means. So I think it takes time, and I do think generally people are responsive, but I, you know, there are people that just aren't, but that's, there just aren't all, you know, for other things as well. But I think generally, I tend to believe that generally people are good people and good in nature. And I think that once you've been able to educate and provide the reasons why, I do think that folks tend to come around.
It's interesting you say that a response might be, it doesn't really mean that. I would think that someone affected by dwarfism or being a little person would have a more firm understanding of what it really means than just your everyday observer.
100%. I'm baffled by it myself. When we were advocating in Manitoba here for sports, and some of the stuff I came up against was baffling of, you know, I'm the one with the lived experience. Why are you telling me how I should feel? And I, yeah, it's baffling for sure.
So in your time with LPA, has there been any individual success moment that stands out for you?
I think with LPA, you know, my time with on the board of LPA has been short so far. I was just voted in the summer. But I think as a whole, you know, before my experience, I think what stands out is the advocacy and, you know, the dwarfism awareness advocacy has been pretty substantial. Some of our successes, you know, with that, and the activism that comes with that, I think is really what stands out. I mean, I know folks sometimes think, well, it's just an awareness month, but it actually leads to so many things, and it creates such a good foundation and opportunity for us to use that month and or that day or whatever, to use it as a platform to make change in other areas. So I think we're, you know, what stands out is probably LPA defining that month as what it is.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward in advocacy and awareness, what would you say?
I would say, you know, for the community as a whole, I would say allyship is incredibly important. And we need allies to take our message and to take it forward and to help us advocate further for us. Change is hard, we know that, but and we're only so many people doing this advocacy work. But through allyship, if folks can, you know, learn and take our message forward, I think that would be the message I would send, is to really, really learn to listen, learn to understand, and then help us take the message forward.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Come one, come all. K-Face Mobile Artistry is teaming up with One Day Dreams to throw an absolutely wicked 90s prom rewind. It will be happening at the Chelsea Music Hall on Saturday, November 12th from 6 p.m. to 1 a.m. the next day. Tickets are $43.45, with a portion of ticket sales going to the local charity One Day Dreams. Anyone can come. The prom will have 90s music, decor, glow sticks, a Polaroid photo booth, and of course, a prom king and queen. This prom will even feature the one and only Strike Tyson Band. It is definitely an event you don't want to miss. Feel free to dress however you want, but the more 90s, the better. You can find the link to buy tickets on the Cake Face Facebook page. Search for Cake Face Mobile Makeup and Hair Artistry on Facebook. Again, that is Cake Face Mobile Makeup and Hair Artistry to buy tickets for the November 12th 90s prom event. We hope to see you there.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Samantha Rayburn-Tribbick told us a little bit about LPA, and Brendan Waite told us a little bit about Fragile X International. In this segment of our show, Barb Reed will be telling us about GRIT. So, can you tell me a little bit about GRIT?
Sure. So, GRIT, well, it's a nonprofit early childhood program supporting children with developmental disabilities and their families. This is our 40th anniversary year, so we're pretty excited by that. And the acronym of GRIT has changed over our 40 years, but we're now referring to GRIT as the tenacity of families raising children with developmental disabilities.
So what are some of the benefits of supporting them at an early age as opposed to later in the school system?
You know, that's such a great question. Certainly what families tell us is the benefits is that our work with families and their children in natural everyday environments, our program is fully provided in the community where 3-year-old, 4-year-old and 5-year-olds would be if they didn't have a diagnosis or a disability. So we're in families' homes, preschool, childcare, libraries, swimming pools, etc., and into their neighborhood school for kindergarten. So we do not have a center where children come to traditionally. And interesting enough, this value and vision was really driven by the 5 founding moms who made this decision back in 1982 to say they wanted a different choice for their child and family than putting their child on a bus and transporting them across the city to a special education program. So, you know, that was sort of the values that grounded GRIT. So in terms of the benefits, back to your question, families really say it sets them on that life course of having their children included in those everyday experiences with their siblings and with their neighbors and peers. So going to the neighborhood school and having those supports and modifications as needed to respond to their individual learning needs. And also the other thing families tell us is it really helps them gain the confidence to have a vision for their child's future, you know, one that they set goals for and reflect on each year to see how well they're doing along that vision.
So it's interesting, when you mention modifications, what are some of the most common needs among these children? Most common modifications?
Yeah, so in this, certainly in early childhood and I would say into the school system, the children that we serve may have diverse diagnoses such as cerebral palsy, autism, Down syndrome. Many of them have very complex medical needs and are in and out of hospital. So the most common supports that they need is any of the daily activities that other children are doing to have them modified or to have a person, educational assistant or whomever, to really support their meaningful engagement and participation. So we're really trying to say, if this is what the other children in the class are doing, what can Cam do with or without supports? And where might he need support? So every child is different. Their needs are different. Their strengths are different. And so their supports are very individualized. And that's something that, as an agency, we are doing in our early years and something we help families to understand to be the advocates when they enter the school system and GRIT is over, because we're only with children and families for 3 years in early childhood.
So I'm guessing that for the other children, being around someone with a disability now will help get them onto the idea that this is just part of life. It's just normal. People are
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, in the early years, they become the helpers, right? They become the resources in the room to help the children do things. I'll help Sarah, you know, Sarah, come, or whatever it is. They're the motivators. They're the helpers. They're the mini teachers, if you will. And certainly in the school system, as the child grows into and experiences higher levels of grades, some of those friendships obviously change. And what what I feel, or what I see sometimes, is that it really takes an extra effort sometimes on the family's part to nurture those relationships. So it might be having play dates, inviting the class to birthday parties, ensuring that if other kids in the class are going to Brownies or Scouts, that maybe they consider if their son or daughter might enjoy that, if that might be an interest or an engagement. So how do families create that sense of living an inclusive life beyond the classroom? And that really makes a difference for those friendships over time.
So in your time with Grit, has there been any success you've experienced that stands out for you?
You know, I have been with Grit a very long time, and I would say the greatest success I had is when I think of my early years, the education system was struggling with the question of whether children with disabilities should be included in neighborhood schools, whether they should be in inclusive classrooms or over there, down the hall to the special education program. And I think the greatest shift I've seen is teachers value that it's right for all children to be included in the classroom, but they don't know how. So then the how becomes our new work of saying, let us help you with your teaching practices, with your routines of how to make this meaningful. Because it's not just children with disabilities who need modifications. The classrooms are very diverse classrooms these days, not what they were 20 or 30 years ago. So many children need different levels of support. And a child with a disability just happens to be one of the children in the class who need additional supports.
So you raise an interesting point in so much as, if it's inclusive for everyone, that would factor in people who have disabilities that might not be known to them. Formal diagnosis of a learning disability, for example, isn't mm-hmm. always something mm-hmm. that a person has. So mm-hmm. if you keep it a level playing field for everyone, create better opportunities, I think.
Absolutely, and I've really come to believe that good teaching practices, using evidence-informed teaching practices for modification or for inclusion, help all the students in the class. It just raises the quality of the learning environment.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you, Cam. I appreciate the conversation.
My pleasure.
All the best.
You too. Something Brendan said during his interview really resonated with me, folks, and so much as sometimes a myth about a learning disability or a developmental disability might lead someone to assume that another doesn't have as much to contribute to society. The fact is, everyone has something to bring to the table. No matter what the disability, no matter what the cognitive level may be, I maintain every life has value. Every person can change the world. Even if you're someone totally nonverbal, totally immobile, say you smile at someone who's having a rotten day. You get them just the right way at just the right moment. Maybe their attitude changes for the better. Never underestimate the value of someone's positivity. It can be very infectious, folks. Fact is, people with disabilities do have gifts. They do have skills to contribute. And even if it's just brightening up a workplace atmosphere, an education atmosphere, what have you, it's still something. And honestly, it is incumbent on us to help them reach their full potential. Everyone can achieve great things if given the right tools, the right opportunities. We have to look beyond the obvious and the superficial. See the person before anything else. In this way, we better not only their opportunities, but our own understanding of the world around us. Fact is, if it were all able-bodied, able-minded people, the world would exist very superficial, very surface levels. But looking beyond, knowing something about disability life allows us to see a vibrant spectrum. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.